not great. I'm not terrible, but I'm not great. Over the last few weeks, my depression and anxiety have continued to rise, making everything I do more tiring, exhausting, and energy sucking. But in the midst of my tiredness, I'm grateful for a few things. Like that I have the space to grieve or process or to cry or just to talk about it and feel accepted by my close friends. It's something I try not to take for granted, you know? Because there are a lot of us that have never had that space to cry, to grieve, to be sad, to be emotional, to be angry, to sit with ourselves. In fact, there's a whole gender that wasn't taught how to show their emotions, and instead believe the many lies that society and generations of toxic men have placed on them.
You need to be strong so you can help others with their emotions first, and you can deal with yours at a later time.
It's the woman's job to keep me sexually satisfied, and I need to wait for the right woman to change my behaviors.
I have been told by both men and women to my face that it's weird and not okay that I have cried and showed my emotions when it comes to my mental health. And that's honestly a painful thing to experience as a man.
Anything regarding mental health was never expressly discussed with me, but it was always expected that I remained in control of myself at all times.
One thing that really frustrates me about growing up in a culture of toxic masculinity is how discouraged men are, and how discouraged I was, to feel feelings of intimacy and softness and express vulnerability. Even now, as an adult, recognizing the importance in feeling those things, I very often feel like I don't have the resources to even access those feelings because of the culture that I grew up in.
The two biggest lies I heard growing up were, one, that as a short man, I was never big enough or strong enough to be a man. And number two, that I was always being too sensitive whenever I was expressing my feelings.
I remember there was a time where I was clearly upset and, you know, just starting to kind of deal with my depression. And I just remember the comment, like, don't tell me that you have any of that depression shit. You're fine. You can deal with it. And I feel now that maybe if I wasn't, you know, a male or, you know, a strong person, that it wouldn't have been the same. I feel like I would have received more compassion. And I played lacrosse all 4 years in high school, and there was definitely a aura in the locker room on the team of just emotionally unavailable people. Every time I was there with the team, around people from the team, I had to act like somebody I wasn't, and that definitely made it hard. And that probably even compounded the issue of my depression in the first place. I know for me, it's always been like hard to notice, because I've never had anyone just come out and say, oh, suck it up, you're a man, be a man. But it's the subtle things that really, you know, dig deeper, but they definitely cause a big impact on your mental well-being.
My name's Grizel, and this is Underneath It All, a podcast that tells the stories of everyday people who have or currently are experiencing mental health difficulties and how the outdoors have influenced them. Although I'm a therapist, these conversations should not be confused as therapy sessions, but instead, open conversations about mental health. My hope is that through these stories, you can have a better understanding of others around you, learn to accept and fully embrace your own narrative, and to continue breaking the negative stigma that has engulfed mental health. Before we get started, there is mention of suicidal ideation in the middle of this episode. I'll make sure to give you a warning, but just know that there's always someone to talk to if you need help. You can reach the National Suicide Hotline Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. On this episode, we're going to be talking about toxic masculinity in a variety of ways. I want to make sure that you all know that this episode is coming from a heteronormative perspective of masculinity, although at the end, we briefly discuss the effects of toxic masculinity with non-binary folks. Initially, I interviewed just one person for this episode, but as I was listening and processing, I realized that, first of all, there's a lot I don't know in regards to the subject. I've never identified as a male, and honestly, I have a lot of preconceived notions about men in general. Identifying as a female, I've experienced my fair share of mansplaining, and I think because of this and a few other reasons, I've put walls up to try and understand most men. Plus, I have my partner, and simply trying to understand him is a wonder and a challenge of its own. However, men are just as human as everyone else. And even though there's an amount of privilege attached to them, doesn't mean that their voices matter any less. So to start, I want to introduce you all to Dr. Christopher Spromberg. He was raised in a small mill town in the beautiful Pacific Northwest, but didn't develop a relationship with the great outdoors until later in life. He recently completed his doctorate degree in clinical psychology and is now working as a psychologist in Montana, where he's making up for lost time by spending nearly every day in the mountains or on the river. Chris is passionate about exploring the connection between masculinity and shame, which he wrote his dissertation on and is working towards publishing some of his findings.
A supervisor in my internship and kind of my residency year say it really well, and I like it, so I'll give him credit for this, that most research is me-search. That most people are doing research to kind of understand probably something that's really close to heart for themselves personally. And if you would have asked me this 5 years ago when I started this project, I would have kind of scoffed and left, I have myself pretty well figured out. But I think this was really kind of a passion project for myself to better understand some of these concepts that I learned in undergraduate about masculinity and the research behind that and how new it is. And better understand these in different ways, both on a kind of a biological sense, as well as kind of psychologically what's happening for guys that are struggling in so many ways.
It does seem that men are really struggling to talk about their mental health. Like, that's the common denominator that I'm seeing. So it sounds like it was something that was really passionate for you, and that's what kind of came out of it?
Yeah, I took a class about men and masculinities in undergrad and really had my mind blown in that class. And ever since that time, you know, I had been working in a lot of different capacities in kind of, you know, counseling or mentorship kind of type roles, and just seeing how there is such a huge need for authentic connection, especially for guys, and how socially that hasn't been socialized and normed. And appropriate for us. And so kind of understanding and seeing, oh, there's actual theory and research now behind this, and getting to see it happen in my real life. And in that first year of clinical training, watching myself and many of my good friends who are also guys in my clinical program really struggle with that last part of that sentence. Man, that must feel really, insert emotion word here, was so difficult, because you just, I didn't have those emotion words readily available, practiced, experienced. My own experience with my own emotions at times felt distant. So really, that's really kind of what led myself to kind of, let's understand this more. I'm seeing it. I'm experiencing it. I want to understand that for myself.
I mean, from the conversations that I have had with several different men, it just seems like the stereotypes of like men don't cry and all of those, you know, things that you've been told as a child, or even if it's not necessarily like directly told, but like indirectly felt, is that the cause of all of this for men?
A bit of it. I think a lot of it boils down to some of those kind of core socially constructed ideas around what it means to be a man, or has meant to be a man in this country. I mean, so much of this conversation you have to have with a really big paintbrush, because we're talking in a lot of generalities. But traditionally and historically, yeah, there's been a very narrow idea or box that has been very rigidly constructed to be a man. And a lot of those kind of walls have been like distance from all things feminine, like no sissy stuff, always striving for achievement, climbing the corporate ladder, being like this big wheel of achievement. Another wall is what one researcher calls the sturdy oak, like a big, tall, sturdy tree, is unmovable, always composed, in control, avoiding vulnerability, tough, strong, sturdy oak. And then there's kind of like the being aggressive, acting dominant at all costs, moving up and getting what you need. So I think those are like kind of these core pillars that create the walls of this act like a man box. Sometimes that's explicitly told to you or explicitly kind of like, this is what it means to be a man. But I think a lot of times it's really implicit in the dialogue, in how we talk and interact with especially young boys. Even if it's like a, yeah, you didn't cry when you got your shot. Yeah, good job for not crying. Whereas if, you know, the little sister's over there crying, like, oh, it's okay. And so I think sometimes it's maybe not explicit, but reinforced implicitly in how we raise young boys. And young boys know the consequences, too, of stepping outside of that box, right? This is every little boy's adolescent experience of learning the boundaries of that box and being put back in the box, mostly by other men, but also by women in our culture, too. If you fall outside the box, if you're not man enough, if you're not striving for success or sexual conquest, you get called these names. And every guy knows those. And they're usually pretty harsh. You get called a mama's boy. You get called a fag. You get called a pussy. You get called stop being a little bitch. All of these things that apply pressure are telling you that you're outside of the norm. You're outside of the box of what it means to be a man. And to put pressure on you, because many of those labels that guys get are associated with the feminine, which is not masculine, which is not in the box. Then the pressure is then to be back in the box. And the only way to get back in is then to prove your masculinity, which is to prove your manhood. And so then you need to ramp up the discourse by either putting the other guy outside the box and discrediting his voice, or proving your manhood in usually a physical fashion. There's a quick ramping up and almost solidifying of this, what it means to act like a man or what it means to be a man. And I would argue that all of it is really shame-based. And so guys, growing up, you know the shame experience, and that's what you're trying to avoid, is being shamed, is being othered in a very gendered way. However, part of being a man is distance from emotion. And so this discourse and this knowingness of shame is embedded into being a man. However, the process and the connection with emotion, ability to process the shame, is disconnected by also being a man.
So it all comes from shame?
In a huge sense, yeah. I think of like rigidness and like really hard boundaries of definitions. A lot of it is so shame-based. I think there's a lot of wrestle that I'm still having with some of this. Like, the idea of toxic masculinity is hard to kind of wrap my head around, because I think it becomes toxic when these core ways of how we've defined what it means to be a man have really negatively impacted people, which by all means, we have 100% seen. However, I identify as a man. And what does that mean? Like, how do I want to identify being a man for myself? And sometimes, yeah, it feels nice to be able to be the provider in my relationship and always challenging, okay, what's the motive behind that? Do I need that for my ego? Or is that something that can be unique to me and my relationship with my spouse, that we, you know, have more of an egalitarian relationship with? And so it's that challenge. Like, I want to always kind of question it rather than just accepting that, oh, this is what it means to be a man, or noticing like initial thoughts or initial kind of prejudices come up about like, well, I can speak up whenever I want to in this meeting because, well, I have the privilege as a man to do that, rather than noticing like, yeah, maybe a lot of the guys have taken up a lot of space in this meeting. And so I don't need to share whatever this idea is right now. Maybe I'll give a little bit more room. The response to shame is usually only two actions, like a shutdown or an activation, right? We think about trauma. Either we kind of like fight or flight, and flighting kind of being the shutdown process. That, yeah, I think so much of this is shame based, and even the process of bringing it back up and talking about it, either I activate it and try to defend it, or I think, you know, and we're seeing a lot of guys like really just shut down and not even engaging in the conversation about masculinity and toxic masculinity.
That makes it really complicated.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, how do you engage in this conversation that inherently on some level pulls for shame response?
So what's the answer to that question?
You still have the conversation. Like, the conversation is worth it. Hopefully it can be held in a safe manner where, as a man, to look at this means to challenge, which means to potentially let go of given, socially given power and privilege. That doesn't mean I can be less of a man. It means we're going to redefine the box. We're going to broaden what it means to be a man, which actually allows me to be more and a better man than what was more narrowly defined before.
I don't often hear men talk about their own toxic masculine tendencies. And honestly, listening to Chris and the knowledge he had about it all was refreshing. However, the effects of toxic masculinity bleed into what is happening in our society today, and the consequences are often fatal. Heads up, there's talk about violence and brutality in the next couple minutes.
When we talk about gender issues, like typically we talk about like women's issues, women's rights, as if like men don't have a gender. And we do this kind of across the board in a lot of kind of different categories. When we talk about specific issues, oftentimes the quote unquote issue that we're focused on is the minority group. And rightfully so. We focused on the victim or the minority group in a way to really support them. However, what often gets left out of the discourse is the group that's actually privileged and holding power. And by not discussing it, we allow that group to maintain the power and the privilege by being unexamined. We would actually have less women's issues if we examined how we raised boys. If we took a look at any of the recent headlines and didn't see a local police officer or gunman, but we saw another man with a gun. And so much of what's going on is in the news and media male dominated by male perpetrators right now. But that gets left out of the discourse. That gets left out of being examined.
Why?
What we have focused in on is maintaining the system of power and dominance. And then to do that, let's look at the victim and how they could have done something different. What if they had just stayed in line and weren't attacking this person back? What if he hadn't shot first or flipped him off? And a lot of that just continues the system where we don't focus on the party with privilege. And by not challenging it, there's a way to kind of maintain the power in that system then. A lot of discourse is changing right now. We're seeing a lot of system challenge and shift. What's being left out of that is often still that men are typically the perpetrators of so much violence that is happening in our country. It's so hard because one of those core ideas of being a man is this rugged independence and stoicism. And therapy is the complete opposite of that. It is like so against the grain for so many men. And the effects of that, I think of, is the toxic part. For a group that holds so much privilege, there's so many negative consequences of being a man. And the impact those have can be so toxic. And I think that's where your apprehension of even having this conversation, I think there's been so many negative consequences externally for men on the people around them, but also internally that don't get talked about as much. We see significant more health problems, suicidality rates, physical health, as well as just kind of like relationship problems with men in their lives. And less men are engaging in quality of life behaviors, health behaviors, mental health, even less engaged in society. Then the question is, yeah, how do we get guys to do something that's so against the grain, so against social norms, so against even the skill set that many guys have? If growing up, you weren't exposed to as much, you know, emotion talk, talking about your feelings, and then you walk into a room and sit down with a therapist and go, let's talk about your feelings. How, like, where do I don't even know how to do this.
So is seeing a therapist for men who don't know how to talk about emotions even effective?
Yeah, absolutely. The APA, the American Psychological Association, just 2 years ago came out with guidelines for working with men and boys in therapy. It's sad that these had to come out many, many years after we've had guidelines for so many other specific interest groups. It can be absolutely helpful. For many guys, that starts with having like peer relationships with other guys where you're able to have these more authentic, vulnerable conversations. Like, see that it's okay, that you're not going to be shamed by opening up to a guy and being like, man, I'm really anxious about this today. And having him go, yeah, man, I get that. Rather than being like, ah, toughen up, just go do it. You'll be fine.
Or not saying anything.
Yeah, or like, ah, whatever, you'll be okay. Guys that have had moments of that and seeing like, oh, okay, I've tested the water and it's not bad. Maybe we can try this we can try this therapy thing out. But I'll say my work with guys is significantly different in the therapy room. Being a man is a significant one because it's a minority of what I see in the therapy room.
Totally. I mean, when we look at men, especially when it comes to talking about mental health, there's just this shame like, well, you have everything else together. Why don't you have this part of your life together? You know what I mean?
Yeah, which that in and of itself keeps men from entering therapy because it's admitting I'm not man enough to have all of my shit together. By even walking in the room, I am challenging my own traditional idea of what it means to be a man. I mean, that's such a narrow and strictly defined idea. You know, down the line, being able to kind of explore that and challenge that idea a little bit of like, well, I wonder if you can still be a man and be emotionally available or be emotionally vulnerable or ask for help. Can asking for help not negate your manhood, but maybe even sometimes make you more of a man? I remember growing up having the most in-depth and vulnerable conversation with one of my best friends, talking about life and I'm sure girlfriends and lost love in high school, kicking a soccer ball back and forth along a crack. And neither one of us looked up. Like the goal was to keep the soccer ball on the crack in the pavement. Early on, like one of the most vulnerable conversations with one of my best friends at that time. And I was like a junior in high school. Like I noticed this with female peers, that, you know, we can have face-to-face in-depth conversation or with a female client, like my chair can be faced straight across from them and they are comfortable. But for a man, like sometimes face-to-face and especially difficult life stuff, that can be threatening. So I'll often even just change my body position or even my chair to face more at an angle from the other chair in the room. That way we can both stare out the window.
Yeah, because it's so uncomfortable.
It's so uncomfortable, especially to face somebody else with what's uncomfortable and allow them potentially to see past this bravado, see past this toxic traditional masculinity stuff and potentially shame me for seeing what's real and what's raw.
So I guess, how do we support and help men who are struggling with emotions? Because it seems like, from what I'm hearing, toxic masculinity seems like it's a consequence of not being able to regulate what's happening in their own mental health. Is that right?
you just strongly encourage them that it's you care about them, that having emotions is a human being experience. And to say that you're not struggling is to say you're not human. Like, I think we're all doing the best we can with this world, but this isn't an easy life. We're emotional beings and we're relational beings. And traditional masculinity has narrowed the potential for both of those things to happen for men. Adhering to traditional masculine values, which my research showed is adaptive for a lot of guys. Because if we think about that, that's still culturally the norm. And so to go against that is to cause internal stress. I grew up in a smaller blue-collar town, and for a lot of guys, it's really adaptive to fit into that more traditional masculine role. And if you don't, well, it is not adaptive for you.
I mean, totally. Therapy is definitely not easy. I think about therapy now for myself. I remember how difficult it was for me when I first started going. But as I continued to go, I guess I've learned how to talk about my emotions and I'm not intimidated by it, you know? And I guess I can empathize with the resistance that so many men have because it is just so foreign for them to put yourself in that position to do something that is just so against what feels innate, you know? So it makes sense to me why it's such a struggle. Before we go any further, I would like to take a moment to talk about our sponsor for this episode, Sawyer Products. Sawyer uses the best technology to make simple products that keep you going regardless of your journey. Whether camping or ultralight backpacking, keeping your family safe and hydrated, or bringing clean water to developing countries. A quick warning that there is a mention of eating disorder in this ad. Becca, who goes by Little Skittle on trail, is a fellow thru-hiker who has found solace in the mental state thru-hiking has provided her since battling an eating disorder.
I hiked the PCT in 2019, and I had intentions after finishing of going after my triple crown.
Becca also planned to do the AT and CVT this year, but is thoughtfully putting it on hold until next year.
I struggled with eating disorders for just over 10 years now, but I found that hiking has been such a powerful tool for my mental health and makes me feel so empowered. My experience in the PCT was like none other though. I've tortured this body for years and then suddenly it was able to carry me some 2,600 miles.
To stay focused on herself and her choices on the trail, Becca kept the Sawyer Picaridin spray on her while hiking the PCT, especially in Oregon, which I totally get. That section was extremely buggy.
With the gear spray and the spray you can carry that's Picaridin, I used that throughout all of Oregon, and that was a lifesaver.
Picaridin actually derives from the piperine molecule found in pepper plants, meaning it's a synthetic replica of a powerful natural solution. It's just as effective as DEET, but it's odorless and grease-free. Win-win. No matter where you are adventuring, keeping a safe-to-use bug spray on you is never a bad idea. And Sawyer's low-odor formula, safe for all your clothing and items, can help you keep your mind focused on what really matters while you're out there, you and your experience with yourself and nature. Learn more at www.sawyer.com. Sawyer, from the backcountry to the backyard. Although Chris is not a neurologist, he researched and wrote a dissertation on exploring the connection between masculinity and shame, as well as the biological factors associated with that. In his first year of schooling, Chris struggled with the disconnect between his emotions and his body, having difficulty identifying feelings other than anger and frustration, which too closely aligned with traditional masculinity. Chris wanted to be able to put more words to his experiences and found that many men were also finding this to be challenging.
Our brain is split in two hemispheres with a band of fibers that connected in the middle. The right hemisphere is typically more artistically kind of minded people if you're right hemisphere dominant. It's also the kind of the more recognition of objects and things happen in the right kind of parietal hemisphere. So I can look at my desk and see the pen on my desk. To put the word pen to what I'm seeing, the information has to come from my right hemisphere and go to my left, which is more analytic, verbal. That process in the brain, I see the pen, that goes to my right hemisphere. And then the information goes, you just saw an object, and it travels through the corpus callosum to the left hemisphere and goes, that object's a pen. There's a pen on my desk. Got it. I don't know why I need to celebrate that accomplishment, but I named a pen. That happens all the time. Whether we're seeing an innate object or a complex kind of social interaction, the more complex it is and kind of more social, the broader the area of brain that's working. But to kind of say like, oh, man, there must be a fight happening between this couple sitting in this coffee shop. This is awkward. Maybe I go a little, sit in one more table over because I want to avoid that. And I struggle to say this because this feels like really generalizing. But what happens is that process is somewhat different for guys and girls. Predominantly kind of at birth, from birth to adolescence, there's very little differences between male and female brains, the sexes at that point. By experience, and once hormones kicks in, that's where we start to see more differences. The classic one for guys is guys have a little bit better propensity for like visual spatial manipulation. So taking a couple blocks and putting them together to make a tower. If this propensity is something that is a little bit easier for me to do, I'm likely to practice that and do that more often than the more difficult things. So that skill gets stronger. And also, I mean, we typically give little boys more blocks to play with instead of dolls, traditionally. Where dolls, you're seeing, oh, these are humans and they interact with each other. Blocks, you stack one, two, three. I made a 4-block tower and now I knock it over. There's not a lot of kind of emotional development. So we see this kind of propensity really kind of then start to build stronger differences. So there's been some research that the corpus callosum differences, kind of sex differences, while there's a lot of variability, kind of generally, the kind of the female corpus callosum is a little bit shorter and a little bit thicker. More information can travel quicker. Where the male one is a little bit longer and a little bit thinner. So it takes a little bit more time. And so to put words to experiences is something that's not practiced developmentally. That's what I was really kind of curious about. Because there's this experience of shame that's socialized and built into men. Like, men know the experience of shame like no other experience and emotion. However, there's a disconnect from emotional experiences. Like, don't feel your feelings. And so what does that look like? How do guys do that kind of on this like subconscious almost level? And so what myself and my dissertation chair did was we took a conformity to masculine norms inventory, which is like a 94-question questionnaire that asks questions kind of based on traditional masculine norms, and you rate how much you agree or disagree with that statement. The quarter of the group that was the lowest scoring on traditional norms, and then the highest quartile, the highest quarter group, that was most adhering to traditional masculine norms. And we found that those were significantly different groups, which I think speaks to kind of where our culture in society is at right now. I think there's some guys who are actually wrestling with this stuff and wrestling with emotions and challenging this act like a man box. And then I think there's guys who that's how they define their self and their identity and double down on it, right? Because it's challenging them. And so the defensive posture then requires me to double down and express my manhood in even stronger, more overt ways. And then from there, we invited our two groups of guys, the most traditionally masculine and least traditionally masculine guys, and we hooked them up to an EEG machine. It records the electrical activity in the brain. The more active it is, the more electricity, kind of on a basic level. We also recorded stress response, so how much they were sweating and their heart rate during the measure. And the measure was we had them view 10 images that had social scenes that were kind of shame-based in the nature of them.
Could you give me an example?
Projective measures is like the Rorschach. So it's kind of an ambiguous stimuli that you then get to project onto. We can only project what we know and experience. And that tells us about kind of a core part of like who we are and the experiences we've had as a human being. And then we kind of took a look at the brain differences. Again, there wasn't a huge difference until the cards were more activating. So the more conflict that was in the cards is actually when we saw the biggest kind of difference between the two groups. So there's one card where there's this group of boys and they're spray painting or have just spray painted a Nazi symbol on a fence of a family, and it kind of portrays the family as being Jewish. And then you kind of see the family kind of running out of the house with the father, I think with a shovel, holding the boy back or something. And then the boys who have just recently spray painted are in the yard about to run away. And the traditional masculine group kind of across the board in hemispheres and brain activity actually had like an inhibitory effect, like their brain shut down when viewing this, where the non-traditional group actually kind of like their brain was more active, especially in the frontal lobes, where kind of the planning and the understanding and figuring out what's going on, that shutting down process, especially in the frontal lobe, oftentimes more of a trauma response. Maybe kind of this more traditional masculine adherence group maybe identified a little bit more with this conflict that's happening here, or the level of conflict that's happening here, and were somewhat traumatized in the past, maybe by conflict.
I mean, that makes sense to me. Eric, my partner, he's an Enneagram 9, so he's very peacekeeper, doesn't love conflict, and wants to walk away. So yeah, it just seems like with a lot of men that when conflict happens, there's this sudden wall, and sometimes it's aggression and sometimes it's anger and even defense, but there's something that wants to shut down, at least for Eric. I notice he goes into like ADHD mode kind of, and he gets highly distracted whenever there's any sort of like unsettled conflict. So maybe that's what's happening, is that actually a lot of these men, because they've never dealt with a lot of the struggles that they've had in the past, it's a trauma response to what's actually happening. And maybe that's why it's so hard to kind of break through that and get to what's underneath the anger and frustration.
Yeah, absolutely. That frontal lobe is so much of a kind of executive functioning, planning and figuring out and processing what's going on. Yeah, it makes sense that like also that's where attention is too. And so if that shuts down, our ability to kind of maintain attention also kind of goes out the door. For this traditional group, like, okay, there's conflict, do something about it, right? Either ramp it up, respond, or, you know, get the heck out if I don't think I can win in it. Where the non-traditional group actually stayed engaged and like, okay, let's figure this out. And the frontal lobe activated for them. That like ability to stay engaged actually correlated with stress. There's just another level that makes it more difficult to talk about my emotions when I come to therapy. This is a stressful experience. I don't have these tools, these coping strategies, or even sometimes the words to talk about what I'm experiencing and relational difficulties and emotions and, gosh, vulnerable stuff. There's no good answer to that question. How do we get guys in therapy? When this toxic masculinity or traditional masculinity can no longer be adaptive, I think that's probably when we might see some significant change happen for some guys.
You know, it's really hard to humble yourself as a female in this world to ask for help. But knowing what we've talked about so far when it comes to men, I can also see why it's hard for them to ask for help. I hear that.
Yeah, it's hard, but I also don't want to like make it a cop out. You still need to do it. Maybe that's where we can hold or subvert some of these traditional masculine things. Like, just do it, man. Like, go ask for help. When I have these conversations, I think about like what would this look like in the bar of my little blue collar town? Well, like stopping the discourse for one, like calling it out, like having guys being leaders and mentoring other guys. That's why I am where I am today, because I had a great set of guys in my life who at different times walked alongside of me and gave me a model of a much broader idea of what it can be to be a man, and that can be okay. And I think that's what we need more of guys standing up in leadership and mentorship type roles, calling out other guys, whether that's in the bar or at the workplace, of like, hey man, that's not cool to talk about. Or, you know, instead of just shooting the shit today and talking about, you know, next baseball game, like, how are you really doing? And just adding that one word, really, not like, how are you doing? Like, oh, good, working, yada, yada, yada. But like, how are you really doing? Well, you know, it's been hard. There's been a lot of transition. Encouraging and modeling and helping other guys to not force the norm or not force the change, but like, just have it be a part of the discourse. To like my own father, who I can remember like him just sharing like his pride in me and telling me that often, like, I'm so proud of you, son. I get tears thinking about that, and how important that relationship is to me, and like how okay it is to like let that be important to me and affect me and have tears over that. I value that in that relationship that I had in high school with a mentor who I had, who was the best man at my wedding, who I remember him telling me about a movie that impacted him, and he started to cry. And I was like, really? Really, man, you're going to cry telling me about this movie? And then I watched the movie and bawled my eyes out, and then needed to call him and be like, man, I'm so sorry. I cried too. This was huge. And so I had all these like these relationships and these mentors and these men who allowed me to kind of redefine what it meant for me to be a man.
Speaking of having a great set of guys, I want to introduce you to another man who is a part of this discourse, Jake Kenobi. Jake is a freelance illustrator and muralist working under the moniker Spring Break Jake. The goal of his work is to make the heavier parts of life feel conquerable by creating lowbrow art with a message. As a self-described indoor kid, Jake has been able to find respite from depression and anxiety in the outdoors, as well as some peace and clarity from a life full of screens, mainly through snowboarding and biking, and as you'll hear, talking about real things. After taking some time talking and learning about his story, I wanted to share him as another resource to men listening and craving leadership online. And heads up, there is mention of suicidal ideation in Jake's narrative.
I was very depressed like all through high school. That was my worst bout with depression, like basically daily suicidal thoughts and ideation. And that was a huge part of it, was just like, once I, even when I figured out like what I was dealing with, it just like didn't even feel worthy or worthwhile to tell someone. The feeling was like, well, whatever, I'm still this like pathetic person, so why would I share this, or why would anyone care?
What was that like though? Like being in high school, being depressed and having suicidal ideation every day. Did anyone know?
No, it was miserable and no one had a clue, because I was still like putting on that front of like the chill, easygoing kid. It wasn't like a conscious thought in my mind that like, oh, this is even harder because of like these traditional masculine ideas that like you men have to bottle up all their feelings. Looking back, like that was a huge part, because it felt like such a weakness to feel depressed and like, why am I feeling this way? Like, I shouldn't be feeling this way. A lot of just like shame around that, fear around telling someone. Like when I finally figured out what was going on and like told my mom about it, I was terrified. Because it felt like I was a bad person for having depression, or just like a weak, pathetic person for something I couldn't control. There was a lot of that built in shame around trying to be a quote real man. It really does kind of take work on both sides. Yeah, I could just like sit my friend down and be like, we're talking about this, but he probably won't be ready to receive that, or like, it'll probably make him super uncomfortable and he won't know how to respond and all that kind of stuff. It is also kind of just like a tough thing to get into. Like typically when you're just like conversing things, you get into heavier and heavier stuff as they kind of come up naturally, but it's not really a natural, easy way to just be like, let me tell you like about my suicidal thoughts. You know, that's like, that's a heavy talk. For me, at least, there was like, just getting over that like awkward hurdle was very difficult, because that's kind of like that's kind of how you have to do it. You just have to like make it clear, like we need to talk about this. Let's do it right now, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah. Do you think that's part of what toxic masculinity is?
Yeah, no, 100%. Like is so much more difficult. Like you're saying, like that kind of natural progress, you're not just doing the sit down, dump everything out. Like the natural progression to those things is so much more difficult and so much harder from like man to man who have those, like who've been ingrained with those ideas of traditional masculinity, because things just stay more superficial. Like it's just, you just like don't progress naturally into those conversations, because those, even the starter conversations, typically don't happen.
How does that make you feel to not be able to not have that as an emotional person, like to not have that opportunity as much?
Yeah, I don't even know. There's really is this deep-seated ingrained mental block, because we're so taught that men don't do that with other men. There's really so many societal roadblocks stopping these conversations that are so necessary. I do like to think it's changing. I mean, there are other people like me out there who like are just actively trying to talk about stuff more. In hindsight, I don't think I would change anything, because like going through especially that major bout of depression, like it made me. Like it really did teach me empathy and like compassion, and just that like everyone does go through shit we can't see and most people don't talk about. And so it, like, you would think, of course I'd not want to be depressed, and like I'd want to get rid of those suicidal thoughts, but like, yeah, it really did shape who I am now, and I am coming to terms with like kind of liking who I am now, and that depression is a big part of that, you know what I mean? Back in those really depressed days, like still recognizing that like I wanted to pursue snowboarding and like leave home, you know, move away, took some courage, and like, but like so much of us, especially myself, I don't think about that as like a positive or give myself any credit really for how far I've come.
It seems that men struggle to share what's going on internally because of the amount of shame they've experienced for that vulnerability, which breaks my heart. I can think of several men in my life that refuse that kind of intimacy, and I don't necessarily blame them. But the reality is, not being able to have that kind of vulnerability affects their relationships with others, with themselves, and even nature. Listening to the shame work that Dr. Chris Bromberg has worked through has created a beautiful space for him and nature.
I love the outdoors.
What do you love about it?
Oh, this feels really cheesy, and I'm like apprehensive to say it. I'll say it though. Mother Nature and the feminine in such a kind of a nurturance kind of way that I've also gotten from so many men in my life, but like from this kind of like nurturing way that like it's so nice is to like engage in something that I feel like is also taking care of me while I'm engaging in it.
How so?
Recently, kind of within the last handful of years, kind of gotten into fly fishing. I run a little bit anxious. I know my own anxiety, and I've been in my own therapy to understand it in a lot of ways. And it is part of me, and you know, something that's never going to significantly go away. And when I'm fly fishing, my anxiety doesn't go away. It's there. And when I'm in the outdoors, it doesn't. Like I worry. Like I just went camping this last weekend, and I woke up in the middle of the night thinking a bear was coming into my pickup truck. I get to have anxiety dreams even when I'm out camping and worrying about things, or am I doing this right, or I better make sure I have all my stuff, which is good. There's an appropriate level of anxiety sometimes. Well, like when I'm fishing or when I'm in the outdoors, my to-do list, my task list goes away. All I'm focused on, all I'm worrying about is the thing that's in front of me, the hike I'm on. Maybe I'm worried about not slipping off this little rocky cliff, and this is kind of dangerous, and why did we come on this rocky cliff hike? All that's on my mind is right in front of me. It's like the most mindful I get to be. And during that time, that's okay. Like I've learned to let that be okay. That I don't need to take care of all these other things in this moment. I can just fish. And if I'm worried about if I have the right fly and am I doing the right thing, and I continue to get stuck in the tree behind me because I'm not that great yet, that's okay. Because this is what I've got right now. This is what's in front of me. And this is all I get to worry about. I wrestle with it sometimes because especially fishing and
even this subset of fishing and fly fishing is such a male-dominated thing that I think, like, you know, I can walk into a fly shop and because I know the lingo and I know a couple of the guys that, like, it can stoke my ego. And so that plays out in a lot of ways, I think, too, in some of these ways where I do kind of hold some traditional masculine things. But when I'm in the outdoors, like, and for me, when I'm standing in the river, I get to be with myself, get to be a man who's standing in the river, who gets frustrated at getting caught in the tree again, taking in the beautiful bird that just flew down the river. And that's all I get to worry about in those moments, is just what's right here. And so that helps me shed these, like, I don't need to be a provider. I don't need to do these other things. I don't need to be, like, stoic. There's no one here to see me get frustrated and yell at the tree for my fly getting stuck in it. It doesn't help me to yell at the tree, but, you know, that's an appropriate outlet for my anger right now. I'm okay being a man who has some anger or frustration or some anxiety about, whoa, what just hit my leg? Oh, just a piece of grass. I'm okay. I was just recently reading an article about, like, men's relationship to the outdoors. It's just talking about the history of, like, seeing the outdoors as, like, a resource that we get to, like, take advantage of, and how, like, traditionally that's been, like, very masculine. Like, I'm going to dominate the outdoors by, like, you know, cutting down this tree. Look, I can express my manhood in this very traditional way by showing domination over nature. Whereas I like to see it as more of a communal interaction when I engage in nature. By no means am I the dominator. I have seen and been in experiences where nature has dominated me, and it has been quite scary, and I have full respect for it, and I get to get the privilege to engage in nature, whether that's on the side of a mountain or standing in a river. Nature is, like, the ultimate, like, equalizer. Like, if you're not okay being vulnerable, you should not spend a lot of time out in nature in, like, in serious ways. And I think that's where, like, a lot of guys have, like, yeah, okay, I'm not okay being vulnerable, so let's dominate it.
Or you have to become this master of this said sport in order to be able to fully enjoy it, you know?
Well, that hit home. Yeah, absolutely. I remember just starting, like, bouldering. I had a client who was, like, really good at rock climbing. He was like, all you do is fail until the one time you succeed, and then you go and fail again. It's like the ultimate, like, vulnerable experience. Like, all you do is go and fail all day. And I felt that when I first started bouldering. I was like, oh, well, I hope no one saw me fall off that easiest climb in the gym. Like, I was losing some manhood or something by doing, like, not being a master at it.
Totally. So I guess as we're closing this up, for the men who are listening to this, who are struggling with this conversation, and I'm just trying to put myself in that perspective, and maybe I shouldn't assume, but I can sense that there's an amount of discomfort in regards to this conversation. Like, I hear this, what the hell do I do? Do you have any final thoughts or, yeah, suggestions?
There is a significant part of, you know, the male population who, like I said earlier, are kind of doubling down. Like, well, that's a bunch of BS. And I would say, like, you know, if it's working for you right now and you feel like you have true, deep, connected relationships where you feel seen and heard, and it's okay to be you, but not just you, but, like, all parts of you, like, even those parts that you've shoved off to the borders or pushed deep down. Yeah, all right, man. But I guarantee that, like, there's probably parts of you that you feel like, yeah, I can't show this. And there's, or told this person about how I'm really feeling. Yeah, welcome to the human experience where life is hard and it's worth it. It's worth, like, opening up and being vulnerable, because on the other end is, like, real honest connectedness with yourself and with others. And you're going to have better relationships on the other end. Men live feeling so alone and isolated, even if they're surrounded by people. And I think that's where we see, like, the suicide rate for guys is so significantly high. And if that's you, it's really freaking scary to open up. And every part of you has said, like, this isn't okay, but it's worth it.
And for the people who are not men who are dealing with the consequences of toxic masculinity, how do we extend more empathy, or maybe not empathy, but how do we communicate better with men who are dealing with this toxic part of their own life?
Maybe that's my answer, is understanding that in some ways for men to step outside the box, there's consequences, known and felt consequences. Just building that empathy and understanding, like, okay, like, this has been adaptive in a lot of ways. For a lot of guys, you know, I see in therapy, like, man, I so appreciate this time. I don't know how I could do this with the guys at the shop. Building that understanding that, like, the cultural norm still promotes in a lot of ways for a lot of guys. I see, and I'm hopeful and really optimistic about, like, there's change and it's happening, but still these roots are so deep and so strong that it's still really adaptive in a lot of ways for guys to kind of hold these traditional values. They're not just, like, perpetuated by guys, but also I think women will perpetuate these traditional values. And so just identifying and building empathy, but also, like, where have I held these, or held guys accountable to these? Or when have I told a guy to, like, man up, grow a pair? I often view the image of holding things with an open hand. In my relationship with my wife, I too hold kind of sometimes some more traditional roles, and she holds sometimes some of the more kind of traditional feminine roles. But we hold it with an open hand of, like, this is what I like to do, and this is actually, like, where I'm passionate about. Like, I don't need to hold it, like, white-knuckling it. And can we have a conversation around it? I want to acknowledge that, too, that, like, so much of this conversation and my discourse around it is in the binary, just because that's where so much of my experience, and I identify as a heterosexual cisgender male, and so I know the tend towards that language much more. The non-binary community has significantly seen the consequences of toxic masculinity and continue to see the consequences of toxic masculinity in so many ways, whether that's traditionally masculine men being threatened by someone identifying as male and causing due violence. But it's also, from what I've seen from the non-binary, the LGBTQ community, is that's really where so much of these conversations around toxic masculinity and redefining what it means to be a man are happening, and happening in these communities of, yeah, what does it mean to identify as a man now or from birth or in the future? And does it need to be this narrow, rigidly defined box? Can it also be this? And I think it's in those communities that I've seen that it's just rich with these dialogues that are happening. And I'm so excited about that.
Special thanks to Chris and Jake for taking the time for this meaningful conversation. I know for me, I learned a lot about how complicated this all is, as well as how I can be there for my partner and my other male friends. After we finished recording, Chris gave me a bunch of resources that you can find in the show notes. I highly encourage you to take a look. Well, that's the show. We'll see you in a couple weeks, so in the meantime, consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen. It's a fast, free way to support the show, and it truly makes a difference in helping other people to find us. And if you're wanting to interact with more of this amazing community, make sure to find me on social media. We're on Instagram at UnderneathItAllPod and on Facebook, including our Facebook group for community questions, stories, and support, which you can find by searching Underneath It All Podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram at _Grizel_ for Mental Health Mondays, where I talk about the balance of my personal life and mental health. You can also follow Jake, who was on this episode, at springbreak.jake to look over his lowbrow art and his awesome messages. You can also follow me at _Grizel_ for Mental Health Mondays, where I talk about the balance of my personal life and mental health. Intro music is created by a two-person band, which includes myself. You can find our music on Spotify by searching Passiflora. Underneath It All is a production of Bravel Media. Until next time, please stay safe and stay healthy. Peace.